This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
So Julio and I have been talking for a long time about...
Especially now during the trip.
Yeah, we had a nice train ride up here. About the film and Rivera. But I realized I kind of wanted an answer to some basic questions. And I thought I'd start with asking why you made this film. I think we never really talked about that. So I'm just curious to hear you talk about that.
Well, thanks. And Sebastian and Nancy and Aaron. And you for being here, and you all. It's wonderful to be here. This film took a few years to make, and I guess throughout the process, the project changed several times too. And although, initially it had to do with questions about work, labor, factory space, and art in Detroit, but it actually began with a series of interviews with Grace Lee Boggs, a Chinese-American philosopher who lived in Detroit for many years. And I think she passed away a couple of years ago. She had recently completed her last book when we began spending some time in Detroit, and that was around 2010, 2011. And the project meant to be, sort of a counterpoint between Detroit during the Great Depression and Detroit now. Diego Rivera and hopefully, some work around Grace Lee Boggs. The interviews with Grace Lee Boggs, by the way, were recorded by Kike Rivera in Puerto Rico. The interviews were done in New York and in Detroit are available under the title of Revolutionary Grace. So that was the beginning of the project. And it evolved into a more, focused archival research. Which is what we just saw.
Okay. So I want to point out, I don't know if you were paying attention at the beginning, because the beginning really does root us in this idea of the archival, and specifically a kind of visualization of the archival. And I was really struck with some beautiful kind of cuts in the beginning, and a kind of emphasis on film equipment, right? The ties being made between the wheel of the projector and the wheel of the car, and then the actual film projector, and then you pull out and then you see the documentary footage of Frida Kahlo drawing at the Detroit Institute of Arts. And so actually we see Frida Kahlo before we ever see Diego Rivera. And I think that's also a very important part of the film. It sets us up. We start with Frida, we kind of end with Frida, and so she bookmarks this story of Detroit's Rivera. So I also wanted to talk to you then about the animations and the choice to animate the political cartoons and her work. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, the first animation is from a historic archive. It's around the Michigan recovery materials at the United Auto Workers collections in Detroit as the Reuter Library in Wayne State. So it's a historic cartoon,
right,
in the factory.
Right.
The animation, so the main animation.
You chose to animate that historic, right? Political cartoon.
The cartoon was a historic animation from
the
archives.
Oh, it was. Okay, right.
Yeah.
Okay, but then...
The main animation is of Frida Kahlo's
painting. The other ones aren't, but there's also other political cartoons from the newspapers that are animated.
That's right. From the newspapers.
Yes.
The newspapers are animated too.
Yeah.
Some details from the newspapers.
Okay.
Yeah, and also the typewriter.
Right.
That's kind of an animation too. But the main animation is of the paintings.
Kahlo.
Of the paintings by Kahlo in Detroit. And as you say, those were fundamental, I think, to have a sense of how the documentary was organized. In some moments, hoping to dialogue or to be, you know, inspired mm-hmm. by the perspective of Kahlo, mm-hmm. Sort of proto-ecological perspective of Kahlo and her more confrontational critique of Fordism mm-hmm. in those paintings, you know, from between 1932 and 33. So I think that's a really good point. Kahlo has, you know, a central role.
Did you specifically choose not to animate Rivera?
Well, you know, I don't think that we ever considered it.
Okay.
Partly because we didn't need to. We had more images uh-huh. of Diego Rivera coming from the archive and from the photographs.
I mean, one could argue you didn't have to animate the Kahlo.
Of Kahlo, we have very little material. Uh-huh. And although, again, in a sense, her paintings, which are very, you know, small format paintings, were fundamental, you know, for our own perspective right. on Fordism. The material was, you know, very, very scarce.
Yeah.
The archival material, right?
Right.
Basically, we used everything we had at hand mm-hmm. and a couple of photographs. So the paintings and the animation of the paintings, it's a painting, the self-portrait at the border, right? And at the Henry Ford Hospital, miscarriage.
So both paintings were made while she was in Detroit.
That's right.
Yeah.
Both both mark, you know, a major shift in Kahlo's career and mm-hmm. and also in terms of her own significance for Rivera. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you would agree, but there is a very fluid form in some I think it's northern panels of the Detroit mural. Mm-hmm. That starts, you know, resembling some motifs in Kahlo's own paintings. It's a more fluid, embryonic references, you know, to.
I actually like to talk about the opposite sometimes, though, in terms of her influence on him. Let me see if I can get to it. Sorry, this is a teaching talk. So let's see. So I love this photo, which I think you reproduce in the...
Yeah, that's right. From a newspaper.
It's from the newspaper, uh-huh. yeah. And I love how he's like looking over her shoulder. She's painting while he's painting the mural, and she's painting in this very intimate format, right? It's 12 by 15. It's a retablo size. There's all of these kind of juxtapositions of, you know, the framing of the door of the car. He's looking over her shoulder. I do think there's something, there's that fetus on the top, you know, that he paints that apparently he switches the cartoon and he does add the fetus later. And I do think that, I don't like to get into biography, but I think that obviously the miscarriage had an impact on him.
Yeah
on both of them.
Definitely.
Yeah. But I think there's something to be said about how, I don't know, maybe she pushed him a little bit. I mean, it doesn't come out overtly in the what the film is so great at exposing is like her, more of her critique versus his kind of ambiguity, right?
Yes, and the critique of Fordism, you know, uh-huh. and the industrial landscape.
Like this painting that has Ford on the stacks, right, and the smoke coming out, and that U.S. industrial side seems so ascetic, right, and then the Mexican side being rooted in the ground and the sun and all
yes.
of
that. Uh-huh. Yeah. So, you know, in a sense, she was, you know, much more critical, you know, of Ford.
Yeah.
Rivera was very ambiguous.
Yeah.
In terms of... his relationship with Henry Ford, and also the whole, you know, industrial production system, which he often considered, you know, very positive, you know.
Although something to take into account, I mean, he gets a lot of flack for this mural, right? And it is an ideological paradox. Like, what is Rivera doing painting for Ford? I mean, it's the question students ask all the time, right?
Yes,
and
they do.
The film is kind of about. but at the time, you know, the mural was perceived as either being too capitalist or too communist, actually. It was sometimes seen as portraying kind of the hardship of labor and as being a kind of critique of capital. So there is a fundamental ambiguity at the heart of, mm-hmm. of the mural, but I think the film brings out very well the kind of social unrest that is the context in which this mural was made, the hunger strike, the Ford massacre, right, that is completely eschewed and elided, right, in the mural. So any kind of critique that's here is quite subtle. Right? Mm-hmm. Let's see, we have other questions. So the film also talked, as I was saying before, is a lot about kind of visuality and this idea that Ford sent in
A cameraman. That's right.
To the and they even said like he's on the scaffolding, right?
Yeah, from the first day,
when
he started working.
Yeah, and so you kind of do this labor, this work of revealing all of this footage that has been shown in documentaries and stuff,
yes.
but not hasn't been considered as a kind of fundamental piece of the puzzle, a piece of the work.
I think so, yes.
And so there's a difference, though, between the film footage and photography. Were you looking at the photographs as well? Because Ford had the whole propaganda machine. We were talking on the train about the Stettler photographs and the Schiller photographs.
Yeah,
are they related?
Well, yes, they were part of the same division.
Uh-huh.
You know, Ford had a film division operating that derived from the photo division.
Uh-huh. So the film derived from the photo?
Yes,
okay.
In 1914. And they worked all up to 1954. And in the early 60s, I think in 63, they donated that collection. You can imagine, you know. It's a major collection of industrial film, which included films, Ford's expansions throughout the world. That's where, you know, the materials on Fordlandia in Brazil also come from. That's in public domain at the National Archives, at the Annex in College Park. It's an amazing collection. Although, you know, some people have previously used, you know, mm-hmm. some of the register, the film register mm-hmm. Of Rivera's process. Mm-hmm. In documentaries, as you said. I don't think that much has been done about industrial cinema itself, you mm-hmm. know, and the role that film plays in the production of the factory milieu and in the actual organization of industrial life. So that was a main thread in the editing process.
We were talking also on the train about how Rivera kind of interacted with the photos or didn't, or with the film. Of all the muralists, he was kind of most resistant to the idea of the cinematic. But this is the slide I actually was telling you about, the mm-hmm. one, the photographic diagram that he used, because he took all the photographs and then kind of created this montage to try to understand the working processes of the factory. And so I kind of use it to talk about the very kind of distinctive aesthetics of the mural that look a little bit like collage, as if he's mm-hmm. kind of, you know, picking and choosing these photographs. But unlike someone like Siqueiros, who very much embraced the idea of the cinematic and commercial modes, Rivera was always a little bit more
conservative. Even in the process of, you know, the drawings, the process of making the murals is much more conservative than Siqueiros. You may be referring to Siqueiros' work around this very same time, you know.
That's right, it's
in
exactly
Argentina,
the same time.
Ejercicio Plástico, He painted in the Botana mansion in 1933, just a few months after this. And you know, Siqueiros, who experimented much more with this expanded sense of mural painting, used technology to project images.
It was interesting in the mass media, right?
Yeah, well, much closer, but also to the actual, you know, cinematic technology, not film itself.
Well, I'm writing an essay right now about his interactions with
I'm
Hollywood.
Looking forward to reading it. We have to talk more.
Yeah, we'll talk more.
Yeah, actually, because, you know, it also, if you look back at the whole discussion of about expanded cinema, prior to the understanding of the expanded arts or expanded sculpture, Siqueiros is a really fascinating example, early example of this mixed use of technology and media. Photography had been discussed many times, as you know, I don't know if you agree. Mm-hmm. Linda Downs, many people had written about the uses of photography by Rivera and other muralists in the process of designing and making the murals. Rubén Gallo has discussed that, you know, in Mexican modernity, he devotes a very interesting chapter to this. But film is a different matter. And Rivera was painting while he was being filmed. So part of the question is, what's the effect, right, of filming on the actual, the enframing that film produces on the actual activity and work of the painter.
That's really more his toolbox, right? He is very much more of a performer, right? He was comfortable in front of the camera. He was comfortable kind of being proselytizing muralism in that way.
Yes.
But he didn't necessarily incorporate it into the work the way that Siqueiros did. And unlike Orozco, who literally hid from the cameras and drew a curtain in front of him whenever there was an audience, right? I think for Rivera, this was like a perfect opportunity, and there isn't a kind of distinction that he would make between kind of forward propaganda and the kind of propaganda, like he embraced that.
He did, although, you know, he was ambiguous at times.
Mm-hmm.
Probably because he felt that the cameraman had some sort of security or a function of vigilance over him. And in fact, that may be one of that is one of the theories in the history of film. Of, for example, in Harum Farouki, the link between the security apparatus and the history of visual technology is very important. Going back to the Lumière brothers, the film he analyzes, you know, actually he uses some of the footage too from the Ford archives, the workers leaving the factory in Lyon, you know, Farouki. And it's a wonderful installation and film about this. The relationship between film surveillance and labor.
Well, that's what I think is so interesting in your film, is that the segment at Fordlandia where the snapshots of the workers.
That's right.
And it's just boom, boom, and the light. And it just
Did you really, get the feeling of...
You get the feeling, and you get the feeling of surveillance that really ties in all those ideas of
film. Did you get a feeling of sort of a biopolitical... scheme operating, right?
And the racial tipos, and there's so much there just in that little footage. And then with the soundtrack, it really kind of brings it home.
But also maybe, you know, I would add a colonial context of this.
Sure. Yeah.
You know, when Fordism was... the word, by the way, the concept itself comes from Antonio Gramsci's essay on Americanism and Fordism that's dated right around the time of Rivera's mural, 1933, from the journals, the prison journals. But he never Gramsci discusses some really important and innovative elements, you know, in his theory of Fordism that have to do with precisely with the disciplinary dimensions of labor and the labor structure in the factory system. The body politics, as we would call it much later, right, after perhaps Foucault. In Gramsci, there's an early discussion of that. But rarely do we see that in a colonial context.
Mm-hmm.
So the colonial dimension in the production of rubber, right, in Forlandia, I think adds, you know, may add a geopolitical map to the discussion of the industrial paradigm.
And then you think, if you think about it, Rivera working in the context of the United States. Right?
That's right.
Something that's... I just want to point out, all this whole mural about the production and creation of the automobile, that's really what the story is about. And there's no finished product in the mural except for this tiny little image, which the arrow is pointing to, of the finished car. Mm-hmm. It's tiny. You can barely see it. So that's just something to think about. Also, Rivera didn't know how to drive. So he didn't even know how to drive a car. So I think that's very interesting to think about in relationship to this. Yeah.
Let me ask you about, Anna.
Yeah.
The perspective here.
Yeah.
You say it's a one-point perspective?
I mean, in this particular segment, right?
Yeah.
It is very Renaissance, right? There is this drama of everything leading, the orthogonal lines leading to that little minuscule car. But if you look at the mural as a whole, I would say it's not one-point perspective. It's almost illegible at points.
Convoluted. Times, right? It's very complex.
And he uses that mechanism of the conveyor belt to structure it, which is so interesting in relationship to Fordism. Because it is a visual leitmotif in a formal.
Throughout.
Yeah.
And it may be the motif that sort of articulates, right, the segments and fragments.
And he actually picks it up then. He tries to use it in his next mural at Rockefeller Center. And it's a leitmotif for the sketch that he does for Rockefeller Center.
But the assembly line, but it's also, it resembles, you know, it's a powerful image of a flexible material.
Uh-huh.
It resembles a celluloid film.
Yep. I like
material.
That. Yeah.
He talks about it as a wave,
uh-huh.
Meaning, you know, an energy, right, that's crossing through the different spaces of the factory. But again, you know, film played a very important role in giving a sense of what the assembly line was segmenting. If the assembly line fragments production, and as you say in terms of, you know, the car appears right at the end of the process, right? Well, in other propaganda material, you would see the car, the commodity, the final product on the first plane. Right?
That's also where I feel a little bit of his critique comes in.
Yes. Showing the process of
right,
labor.
Right, that it's about the labor.
Yes.
Yeah, that it's about these people on the assembly line. That it's not about the commodity or the product per se.
Yeah, and then we can always talk about, you know, what's the how does he depict the body, the workers, right? I don't know if how do you see it?
Well, so this is again where the ambiguity
comes. It's a discussion,
right? It's a discussion because people talk about it as a rhythmic ballet, right?
Yes. Do you think about that?
I also see it as disequilibrium. I see it as destabilized. I see it as convoluted. I see both.
But the rhythmic ballet may be on the other.
The north wall.
The north wall.
Yeah.
Do you have it at hand?
Mm-hmm.
That's it.
Yeah. Yeah, it does.
This,
yeah,
I mean, it's very symmetric. The use of the arms and the legs, right, of these workers.
Right, and they are much more heroic as bodies.
They are heroic.
Than usual.
Yeah.
And in other parts. So if we look on the upper left, we will see older, wrinkled, green workers that look sick.
Including Rivera.
Including Rivera.
Looking greener than ever.
In there,
Very green. But you know, something that's missing, Anna, here has to do with the more intense suffering.
Yeah.
Or, you know, just the physical, you know, exertion, right, of labor. And I think you studied that elsewhere in the New York murals.
Mm-hmm.
In the portable MoMA murals.
Right.
Do you find a different take on the body?
I simply think Rivera was fascinated with the technology here. And
I think so too.
And he just couldn't see past that. He just was amazed by this factory.
Yes.
And you know, when he says something like Fordism provides the way for socialism.
Yeah.
So yes. For him, he really does see it as a kind of pathway to a kind of technological and labor utopia.
And
as faulted as that is.
By the way, it also in the Soviet Union, that was a part of the discussion from the mid 20s on. And this is something that Terry Smith has commented on. Albert Kahn, who's the architect designer of the River Rouge factory. After the Depression, he ended up in the Soviet Union designing factories for Stalin, Albert Kahn, the same designer, architect that worked with Ford in the River Rouge. But also, you know, this link that you have also studied between Rivera and productivists in the Soviet Union, Rodchenko, you know, the follower after the constructivist.
Mm-hmm.
But that small moment, you know, of art and production in 1928, he actually attempted to collaborate with them.
Right.
It didn't turn out, but
was
that a view of technology? Do you think that was something that was coming from his communist Marxist?
I think that trip to the Soviet Union definitely impacted him, and you see the shift.
It was in 28, right?
In 28, and you see the shift at the Secretaría de Educación Pública. You see the figures, the Soviet-like figures you see, but you also see the kind of formal aesthetics from Russian constructivism appear, as well as that kind of politics. I think there's no doubt. But then it kind of peters out. And so then you he finds himself...
And he's expelled from the party.
He's expelled from the party, but he's always trying to get in. It's always a gambit. Like, how can I get back in?
Why would one want to go back to the place you've been expelled from, right?
Yeah. I mean, he wanted to be the spokesperson for... He wanted to be this, you know, social realist painter.
That's right.
That represented that. How are we doing?
You know that the man with a movie camera, by Bertov, from around those circles, mm-hmm. you know, in the late 20s, was very important, I think, in terms of, you know, the ways in which we discuss the question of technology,
mm-hmm.
in terms of industrial labor,
mm-hmm.
and it was very present in the work with the editors of the documentary.
And so that's what's interesting in the film, too, how labor is depicted, whether it's on the assembly line, but also vis-a-vis materials. So the labor of mixing the paint, right?
Yes.
There's a long pause on thinking about materiality and the different material, and the rubber, and it's all kind of tied together. I don't know if we have a comment about that.
Yeah, I mean that's something that both photography and especially the moving image leads to, you know, this relationship between objects, bodies, right, and also this question of perception that was always the matter of discussion for filmmakers, avant-garde filmmakers, you know, like Bertov.
Terms of muralism, it is part of the mythology because it's a public art. You know, Rivera was very much the person who mythologized this idea of fresco and the labor of fresco and the model of having assistance, of grinding the paint, of wearing overalls, of it being paid like a house painter. It's very much part of the ethos of muralism, and I feel
painting
like
as work,
painting
as
a form
of labor.
Yeah, and painting as if you were, painting a house, you got paid by the square foot instead of, well, of course, you got paid more, but the origins
very
of
significant
it, yeah.
thing in Detroit, significant.
Didn't he double his commission? He was supposed to be paid $10,000, and he asked for 20.
$25. So then he went to New York,
in Detroit,
confront Rockefeller.
In the middle of the Great Depression. yes. in the so middle of a financial crisis.
Very significant.
But know, Ford paid it, Edsel Ford.
So Edsel Ford.
The son of Henry yes. Ford.
Yes.
But it was very much part of this kind of mythos. And so I feel like even the archival footage, the propaganda from Ford, also kind of capitalizes on that a little bit. It was what interested people. You know, it was a kind of unknown way of working in the United States. Of course, there's fresco in government buildings and in the 19th century, but it wasn't very common to paint in fresco.
Until the muralists. And he had later in the States, after the WPA, he must have had a major.
But then, WPA was inspired by the muralists.
By the muralists. Yeah. That's one of also of your arguments. Mm-hmm. You know, going back to the painting as work, there's something about the hand, you know, in the footage that we worked on. And there's such a difference, you know, between the place of the body and the hand in the process of painting a mural. Or even of breaking down the wall, you know, and the sort of extreme subsumption of life in this process of automatization in the factory. And I think film is very sensitive to the different rhythms of the body and the different rhythms of movement, of energy, you know, of heat, in a sense, right? Being distributed in the factory,
and making a mural is a very physical.
It's very physical, but it's a different kind of physical work.
Yeah,
because it's work. You know what I'm thinking about also is the assembly line and early discussions, for example, in Harry Braverman, the book, classic book by a worker, factory worker, by the way. Labor and monopoly capital, automatization, Fordism, and the scientific management of time, Taylorism, in the factory, produce a major division of labor and between management and intellectual functions in the factory and the body that was more and more reduced to a part of this great machine. That's Chaplin's theme, right, in modern times. So this question of this division of labor has effects on art, has effects on the time of art, not only in the ways that the image represents different temporalities, right, but also the actual perception of the image and the role that the body plays in different kinds of production.
So how do you see that at Detroit?
In the work of Rivera, I think that one of Ford's interests in sending a cameraman, well, on the one hand, to produce some kind of magnificent, an epic of labor in painting that legitimized his corporation, but also the interest in how different kinds of work. Because the archive is full of that, images of different kinds of activities, all kinds of activities. It's an archive, really, of footage on labor. And the question was already there, what kind of work does art do? Is it only the question of legitimacy that we're talking about? That was a part of it. Or is there something else, that film captures in terms of art? What does art produce in this age of fragmentation and industrial segmentation, right? Mm-hmm. What is it art's labor? I think there was it's a question that was also being raised by corporate capital itself, the meaning of art in this kind of society, right?
And there was much more of an alliance between capitalism and Marxism, socialism at this time than people realize. Rivera made a cover for Fortune magazine. This is pre-Cold War, and so there is much more of a kind of alliance that people, a different mentality, I think, in the 30s.
Yeah, in the 30s, definitely. And even the link between Ford, and which we have also discussed, and Roosevelt, and And you know, the movement towards the 30s, you know, after the Depression, Fordism, you know, has a very contradictory place there, and even in Ford's own writings, very distant actually from what we consider, you know, this financial capital, very different.
I had a question about the title.
Yes.
So
what does it?
So why trigger? Detroit's Rivera, and not Rivera's Detroit? Sorry, well, it's a very basic question, but
no.
it fascinates me.
Yeah.
It implies there are other Riveras, or is that not what you were trying to get at?
Well, it's the Rivera that was made possible by Detroit.
Uh-huh.
It's also the Rivera of the River Rouge, uh-huh. Right? It's a packed factory along the river. The Rivera was, but it also had to do, you know, with this the entanglement, the predicament, right, of a painter who had done public art before, obviously. You know, four or five major murals for the Mexican state, but never for corporate, you know, capital. So it plays.
Although it is
really
for a museum, it is in the context of a museum. But yes, paid for by.
That's right.
Yeah,
yeah. It wasn't directly.
Yeah.
It wasn't directly by the Ford Company. It was, you know, through Edsel Ford, who was part of the. Of the museum.
But it exists in a public institution.
Yes. And a museum that historically, by the way, you know, was challenged by Rivera's murals. It was a major museum at the time. It was probably the third museum in terms of its collection. Rembrandt's, you know, and very Western, canonical, you know, the collection in Detroit. Well, Rivera added something there that wasn't really expected until recently, you know.
They tried to
sell it. So, you know, it created a lot of tensions and, you know, that it's a singular Rivera, you know, made possible by Detroit. That was the feeling we had about it. By the way, the film, I Do Mind Dying, you know, I think it's a phrase from Rome, right, from Colonel General, I remember, the activist died 3 years ago in Detroit, probably early 1970s, right, close to Santiago Alvarez, kind of, you know, montage, very important film, very polemical. It created, you know, major tensions in Detroit. A very important film about suffering and in the factory. Something that I think this question about precarity comes. I think it's more clear in terms of unemployment in 1932-33. The employment had been cut down to half. In the River Rouge factory. It's a factory that employed over 100,000 workers in 1928-29. So during the Depression, the production of cars went down half. So the Hunger March in 1932, you know, filmed by the workers, Film League, had a lot to do with unemployment and extreme poverty in Detroit during the Great Depression. In the factory, there's something else. It has to do, again, with the dynamics between technology and the human body and labor. And the way industrial machinery changes the very nature of time, you know, and it's, with, you know, a major way of reorganizing the role of work during, you know, conditions of extreme time management, scientific time management, which, by the way, you know, explored the uses of film in the early theories of time management, what derived from Frederick Taylor, right? They used film to calculate time, scientific uses of you know, management of labor. That also involves, I think, the subsumption and domination of life and the alienation of the workers' own capacity to knowledge, you know, in the shift of from a craft and the worker as a craftsman to the worker in the factory. You know, there's a major shift that involves suffering, exploitation. Rivera, I think, it's depicting that, but in very aesthetic terms. So the question of form has to do, I think, with the role that form takes here as a way of ordering the bodies along an aesthetic line, right? That I think at times it means to construct an epic of labor, an idealization of labor. That's very problematic, and I think part of the even the in part of the, what the film means to show, you know, are these tensions and contradictions between form derived from different materials, right? Between labor and the different activities that organize life, including the miscarriage in Frida Kahlo's painting and the suffering, the physical suffering that she portrays.
You know, it's tough. I like this idea of considering it a memorial and looking at it as a kind of memorialization of violence, but that's that. It's difficult, right? The one, you know, kind of literalization of that, or one could say, where is it? Let's see if it's here. Right, the famous Coatlicue, right, that is
yes.
Aztec sacrifice. Right, the earth goddess of death and life. Right, I think there's a reason why he chose that, and I think it's more than just trying to Mexicanize this factory. I do I have a sense that this is about sacrifice, ritual. He's making this kind of metaphor. Again, it's subtle and nuanced, but it's there, and it's about violence.